I've never really used one of these. Tell me, Mr. Bannon, what do you have to say about this?
It's an all-new, all-different podcast from Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. My name is Rob Farley. Today, I'm going to be moderating a conversation about Justice Brett Kavanaugh, his confirmation hearings, and the future of the Supreme Court. Joining me will be two Lawyers, Guns, and Money front pagers, Dr. Scott Lemieux, currently a lecturer at the University of Washington, who is one of the co-founders of Lawyers, Guns, and Money, and Professor Paul Campos at the University of Colorado School of Law, who has been with Lawyers, Guns, and Money since 2008.
All right, gentlemen, I guess first things first, what were sort of briefly the impressions that you took, sort of the most important things that happened in the recent Kavanaugh confirmation hearing, the process of the hearing itself? Scott, why don't you go first?
You know, obviously, the way it transformed from, you know, a standard, you know, here's another, you know, neo-Confederate handpicked by Leonard Leo to, you know, the sort of replay of the... you know, Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas issue, but with much more serious charges, as Paul pointed out, and with it playing out the same way, with, I guess, the exception that Democrats this time are actually united, and Republicans sort of, you know, showing that they didn't care. But, the, you know, the most striking thing, obviously, was Kavanaugh's, you know, interminable, you know, Daily Caller column, when, you know, called before the Senate Judiciary Committee again, you know, and apparently my understanding now is that that strategy was actually largely dictated by the Trump administration and was very successful. And, you know, it really says something that simply, you know, going all in and making no pretense about his partisanship you know, insulting the Democratic senators as a way of steamrolling very credible accusations of sexual assault, and let us not forget his just, you know, repeated perjury, often about stuff that he had no particular reason to lie about. I mean, the striking thing is that if he just said, you know, yes, I was a teenager and I sometimes drank to excess and had immature attitudes about women, this would cost him zero votes. It's just, you know, essentially in the age of Trump, you just, you know, rallying the party around you is the best way of succeeding and sort of steamrolling everything. So it's really, it's a symbol of how deeply Trump has embedded himself in the Republican Party, but also where Trump came from. You know, we have to remember that Brett Kavanaugh is a guy who, you know, literally spent millions of dollars investigating Vince Foster's suicide. So, you know, it's not as if, you know, this is his first time as part of a, you know, a highly partisan Republican operation. So really, it's sort of, you know, shows that, you know, not only, you know, that it's Trump's party, but why is Trump's party?
Right, Paul?
Yes, I would only add to that, that the most stunning aspect of the hearings for me was the extent to which a kind of legitimation politics completely whitewashed Brett Kavanaugh at the beginning, in the middle, and of course, most strikingly, at the end. As Scott says, this guy, it's not as if he didn't have a very well-established track record as an egregious Republican hack of the worst kind. And somehow it was repeated over and over again that he was this sterling figure that no one had ever had the slightest complaint about in his entire life, and he was now being slandered on the basis of not only no evidence, but an enormous amount of evidence to the contrary, which I found really extraordinary, given that it was repeated over and over again that that Christine Ford didn't have any corroboration for her claims. Well, where was the corroboration for any of these claims about Brett Kavanaugh, about what a great guy he supposedly was? There was essentially none. The only thing that was brought forward were obviously spurious bits of propaganda, like this letter signed by like 65 women who happened to go to high school in like D.C. in the early 80s. And it was just an extraordinary spectacle. And let us not forget that the groundwork for all of this was laid at the very beginning of the process by a couple of supposed liberal law professors at Yale Law School, singing hosannas to Brett Kavanaugh, again on the basis of basically a completely imaginary and spurious biography for which there was no evidence.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and obviously Paul's been writing about this from the beginning, and that really struck me, you know, that obviously these people didn't know that he was guilty of sexual assault. But the thing about this ritual, you know, the Akil Amar and Lisa Blatt, all these, you know, arguments about his character is that, or Ben Wittes, I think, would be another excellent example, though at least he repudiated him. But these people are making character judgments who obviously are not in a position to have any idea about his character. You know, that just, you know, like being a social acquaintance or, you know, occasionally sending your students to his chambers just tells you absolutely nothing about his character. And there were a lot of things, such as his longtime association with Alex Kaczynski, who anybody, who teaches at Yale Law knows, you know, goddamn well about, you know, his reputation. It's just really ridiculous. In some ways, I mean, at least, you know, those articles about how he's a great, you know, carpool dad are embarrassing and shouldn't have been published, but they at least, you know, refer to things that people have specific knowledge about. Whereas these broad arguments that he's just the greatest guy in the world, you know, are all being made by people who are just not in a position to know. And it was really just embarrassing. And the number of academics who signed the pro forma, you know, isn't it great for Yale Law School that another one of ours is going to be on the Supreme Court, given his history, was just really, as Paul said repeatedly, it really says a lot about sort of elite legal academia and elite law practice circles, and I would say none of it's good.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, what I'm getting is this: we're sort of rehashing the Phantom Menace here, right? It sucked. We agree that it sucked. So, you know, looking forward, right? Sort of the audience for this podcast is interested, and there's been a lot of question about, you know, exactly what kind of impact Kavanaugh will have on sort of the future of the court, right? In terms of, you know, what we might think about specific cases, like how, in what way is he likely to be different from Anthony Kennedy? Paul, why don't you go first and then Scott?
Sure. Well, I think he'll be different from Kennedy on a couple of key issues. I don't see any reason why he would vote to uphold gay marriage as a constitutional right. There's nothing in his background that indicates that he would do that. The only thing that would save that opinion, I think, would be John Roberts deciding that it would be impolitic to reverse it. He shifts the median vote on the court to Roberts, but what exactly that signifies is difficult to say for sure, in that Roberts is such a slippery character himself. But there's no question that Roberts is significantly more right-wing than Kennedy was. As Scott has pointed out, Roberts is one of these people who only votes with the liberals when it doesn't make any difference, with the exception of the ACA case. So that wasn't true of Kennedy. Kennedy did vote with the liberals on a couple or three issues, on a number of occasions. And so I think Kavanaugh is, you know, it's not mysterious. He's clearly shifting the court significantly to the right. How far right remains to be seen, but he is, there's nothing in the slightest bit ambiguous about him. And this is, you know, this is basically what the whole Federalist Project was about. The Federalist Project was all about getting some, you know, neo-Confederate hack on the Supreme Court who you could be absolutely certain would vote the quote-unquote right way on any question that the right wing in this country really cared about. And I think that that's what, that there's absolutely no basis to think that they're getting anything but that with Kavanaugh, and it would be shocking if they turned out to be wrong about that.
Yeah, I've been meaning to write about this, but the key here and what makes Collins is, well, you know, pundits were wrong about David Souter, so who knows, arguments so irritating, is that, you know, there's the story of Jeffrey Sutton, you know, who's, you know, a judge on the Sixth Circuit, still only 56 or 57, and he has not been on any of these shortlists just because he wrote an opinion that refused to strike down the Affordable Care Act, not because, you know, he wouldn't have done it on the Supreme Court, but because, you know, he didn't think as a circuit court judge he should overrule Gonzales versus Wright, which had been decided less than 10 years ago. And, you know, Wright makes, you know, the challenge to the Affordable Care Act, you know, all, you know, just dispositively rules it out, basically. So all of these lists are about just weeding out any hint of unorthodoxy whatsoever, so that there's just, you know, nothing can go wrong from a conservative perspective. So, yeah, I mean, it's important. You know, it's true that, you know, as Roberts becomes the median vote of the court, he may shift left on a couple of other cases that aren't central to the Republican movement. And I do think Obergefell is one where I get the sense that Republican elites are not very committed to to kind of reinstating bans on same-sex marriage. So that would be an excellent opportunity in a high-profile case to, you know, to kind of say, well, stare decisis, blah, 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 like Rehnquist did in upholding Miranda, which, again, I think by that time, you know, police officers and departments are perfectly happy to live with. They figured out that it wasn't something from getting confessions. But there's still a real difference. You know, I know the most recent data I've seen, in 2012, Kennedy had joined a 5-4 decision with the four other liberals more than 20 times, and that doesn't include his 2016 term, which was the most, you know, his most liberal, including on cases like fair housing, affirmative action. You know, Kennedy, you know, really was willing to join with liberals, and not just in same-sex marriage or abortion. And pretty much all those are out the window. You know, certainly Roberts seems, you know, aggressively anti-affirmative action. You know, one of his worst opinions ever was parents involved. So I don't think he's evolving on that issue. You know, and generally just on civil rights and voting rights, Roberts is just, you know, as Paul said yesterday, is 100 times more dangerous than Scalia, because, you know, his views are indistinguishable from Jesse Helms's, but he's much more careful about expressing them. So, you know, we don't know for absolute certain how it's going to play out, but it definitely shifts the court substantially to the right. And on any issue that is at all important to Republican elites, Roberts will always vote with conservative coalition. The other thing I'd point out, too, is that there is significance that Kavanaugh, especially on the regulatory stage, is willing to stake out, you know, fairly radical positions. You know, at the beginning, he might be doing that in concurrences, or whatever, but that sends signals to, you know, lower court judges, and that has the effect, like Thomas has, and I think Gorsuch will have as well, of kind of, you know, making, you know, kind of shifting what is an orthodox Republican view to the right. So one real danger is that, you know, conservatives of the 80s and 90s, as Ian Millhiser has pointed out, you know, weren't really, the federal courts weren't trying to undermine Lochner, you know, weren't trying to sort of bring back the court as an economic legislator, and, you know, slowly that's becoming more and more respectable. So I think Kavanaugh will also have an effect in terms of just staking out further and further right opinions, which, even if they don't have 5 votes today, could have 5 votes once, you know, Republicans ever get a 6th vote or a 7th vote or whoever, because it affects what is considered the orthodox position, you know, and people who don't want to be the next Jeffrey Sutton and get sort of, you know, excluded from Supreme Court consideration have to keep up.
Right. That's actually a really interesting point that I think both of you there made, sort of this argument that, you know, conservative judges are adjusting their jurisprudence in order to be acceptable to the Federalist Society. I mean, is that what sort of you're suggesting, so that they, you know, can continue to move up the ladder of federal justices?
I think that's clearly happening. I mean, having seen this operating inside of law schools and in the judiciary itself, I mean, discretion, I'm not going to name individuals, but I have seen people within the legal elites clearly make strategic decisions on the basis of calculations in regard to what is it that is going to get them some kind of a shot first for a circuit court, federal circuit court clerkship, and then ultimately for a Supreme Court clerkship. And the Federalist Society has enormous power in this regard. It lays down the markers. It makes very clear what kinds of deviations are perhaps permissible and which aren't. And the people who these blandishments are aimed at are extremely susceptible to this kind of pressure because they are consumed with ambition, as I thought was very clear in regard to Brett Kavanaugh, who's a guy who has spent the last, you know, I guess probably 25 years of his life just fantasizing about getting on the Supreme Court, which is why he – one of the reasons why he freaked out so thoroughly when it seemed that the brass ring was being taken from him at the last minute. I don't actually go for the for the interpretation of Kavanaugh's behavior at the sort of infamous Thursday hearing as being some kind of, you know, method acting performance on his part. You know, I think he was genuinely enraged. Because here's somebody who had done everything right, which is to say that he had completely prostituted himself for his entire life to get to this point, and it was being taken away from him by what he saw in a genuine sort of classic, you know, right-wing paranoid fugue state as a conspiracy, you know, a Clinton-led conspiracy. And let's not forget he actually said that, you know, under oath to the nation, that a Clinton-led conspiracy was what was behind Dr. Ford's and Ms. Ramirez's accusations. And so, yeah, I think that is definitely happening. And it's a profound corruption of the process. And I don't necessarily believe that anything like our present system can actually survive this kind of wholesale corruption.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, yeah, when I said that there was some strategy involved in the hearings, it wasn't so much that he was method acting as that Trump encouraged him to say what he was really thinking. That, you know, during the hearing, you know, the first time he appears before the Senate, his job is to kind of say, I am a nonpartisan umpire, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That really what he was doing on Thursday was, in a sense, expressing, you know, just, you know, letting fly what he actually thought, which was both the best politics. But yeah, I agree, it wasn't acting. He was exactly as enraged as he saw, which you really saw in particular in the interactions with Klobuchar. The fame, you know, the well, have you ever been blackout drunk part? You know, it was really just, you know, the sheer contempt he had for anybody standing in the way of what he believed he was entitled to, and obviously not coincidentally his contempt for women as authority figures. You know, all just came through so clearly. You know, and that clearly isn't scripted. You know, that's not, you know, that was his. That was itself, and it's frightening how effective it was. And it was also good that, you know, that at least we're not going to be hearing about reasonable, moderate Lindsey Graham ever again. Good things to come out of this. But yeah, and that's really you know, and that's exactly right. That the Federalist Society has just been terribly, you know, effective at creating these orthodoxies. It's a major reason Donald Trump is in the White House. You know, it really is that, and there's really, and again, it's another hack gap thing. There's really no equivalent to this on the left. You know, the American Constitution Society is good, but it's not nearly as well funded. And, you know, liberal academics and lawyers, I think, to our credit to some degree, don't want to be this orthodox and this methodical. But it really does create a major power asymmetry. And I really, again, I think I've said this on the blog recently, but I really strongly recommend Amanda Hollis-Bursky's book about the Federalist Society and American conservatism, which is really one of the, you know, the most important books to understanding where we are that I can think of. But it really is. And that's also what makes, you know, sort of liberals going along with this all the more infuriating, you know, pretending that, you know, and again, for some of you, and it's not like, you know, Akhil Amar is a hack scholar, far from it, but for him to just pretend that, you know, Brett Kavanaugh is you know, a you know, serious nonpartisan thinker. You know, I think Iglesias has been making this point repeatedly, but it's amazing the extent to which liberals who wouldn't give a typical Republican senator the time of day will treat, you know, a judge or a legal academic who makes exactly the same arguments, you know, as a perfectly respectable figure. There's just something about the cult of the court or the legal profession or whatever, which just causes, just sort of wanders conservative arguments and makes them more respectful. You know, like we saw Richard Epstein make one of the dumbest pro-Kavanaugh arguments, you know, just repeating every stupid Trump talking point imaginable. I mean, the guy wrote a book about how, you know, the takings clause makes the entire 20th century welfare state unconstitutional and makes that as an originalist argument, as if that was, you know, and yet has, you know, basically spent his whole life at the very top of legal academia. So there's something about, I think Paul probably is better positioned to speak about this than I am. There's something about, laundering standard, sort of extremist Republican views through legal discourse that somehow, just sort of acts as a, acts as a sanitizer and sort of gives them instant respect they wouldn't have in any other context.
Yeah, I think a big part of what is happening in regard to the culture of the court and the legal elites is that liberal left people literally cannot believe what has happened. You know, they cling so much to this idealized vision of the relative integrity of the federal courts, and it's a vision that historically has certainly not always been mistaken, but in the course of the last generation, they can't face up to what has happened, part of it is just sort of craven careerism. You want to get your students clerkships. You want to position yourself in terms of potential advancement either politically or judicially. But part of it, I think, is just this kind blindness to the extremity of the situation. There's, Dahlia Lithwick, who's somebody who whose work I admire quite a bit, wrote a piece immediately after the Kavanaugh Thursday testimony, in which she suggested, and I don't want to criticize her too much for this because I think it was a heat of the moment kind of thing, but she suggested that the Supreme Court ought to vote as to whether Brett Kavanaugh ought to join them. It was sort of a cry from the heart, essentially, in which she was saying, let's at least give this institution, a chance to show that it's not as dirty as the process that is putting Brett Kavanaugh on the court. And, I just wanted to say to her, look, wake up and smell the coffee. This is the age that we live in. This process has been captured by people who are very ideologically disciplined. And Scott's absolutely right here that there's a huge hack gap because liberals, they don't have that kind of discipline, which I agree is, sort of partly to our credit. In the same way that you can say, well, it's to somebody's credit that you might say that they might not make a particularly good soldier or something, right? They don't have enough of a taste for sort of violence and authoritarianism. But it's a huge problem pragmatically, and I don't know that there's any obvious solution to it. I'm not trying to be too much of a Cassandra here, but in terms of the long term, which I believe is something we should be focusing on in this context for sure. This is a catastrophically bad situation, and I don't know what is likely to save us other than some combination of a lot of good luck or potentially some sort of massive overreaching on the part of the court. I mean, if they actually go and get, Randy Barnett's constitution, and Richard Epstein's constitution, like fired up, or like where you declare the entire regulatory state to be unconstitutional. I mean, I'm sort of assuming the American political system wouldn't tolerate that. But on the other hand, I would have thought the American political system wouldn't have tolerated Donald Trump, and I turned out to be wrong about that. So, we'll see.
Right. Now, I want to push forward here just a second. So, and this will kind of drag us a little bit back to the question of the investigation. So, there are still multiple people who are looking into a variety of allegations against Brett Kavanaugh, right? You guys have both talked about these. There are financial questions. There are questions of his, of his performance on the court. There are still lots and lots of questions about his personal behavior. Is all of this just sort of screaming into the wind at this point, or is there any possibility that these investigations are going to be taken seriously by any way in a sense that's going to have any consequence at all?
I would say it's like the investigations into Trump, whereas if we're talking about are we going to find something that's getting going to get him removed from the bench, obviously not. I was on a panel at UW's law school yesterday, and one encouraging thing is that it was sort of you know, it was done on about 5 days' notice. We had a standing room only crowd at a big, so there's at least some interest in judicial nominations again. But obviously, you're not going to find anything that's going to get 20 Republican votes to remove from office. And we really shouldn't be talking about impeachment, but stuff can come up that further discredits him. You know, and as Paul said, you know, it's really amazing that, in addition to sexual, that this, six figures of credit card debt that mysteriously vanished has just not gone, it's never got an explanation for that. I mean, I don't know about you two. I think all been a part of season ticket groups before. I personally have never lent, most of my take-home salary to my friends in a year and not really expected to be paid back unless I got an Article III judicial appointment. I can't speak for the two of you, but I'm guessing that's not common practice. And we've never gotten, an explanation. So there's a lot of things, especially if Democrats take over the House, can come out. And it's worth doing because, one of, as I wrote in my recent NBC piece, the Republicans have really been able to have their cake and eat it too, and that the courts have been controlled by Republicans since early in the Nixon administration. They've moved steadily and steadily to the right. And, although Kennedy is much better than Kavanaugh, he was still pretty bad. Shouldn't forget, he was still a very conservative justice. And yet, conservatives both care a lot more about the court and, dislike the court a lot more than liberals. So we had this extraordinary thing in 2016 where Mitch McConnell stole a Supreme Court seat from Barack Obama, and it was mobilizing two conservatives. And maybe Clinton should have talked about it more. But what that tells you is that, Clinton's polling team basically said liberals seem to be okay with this. And I think that's partly because of the assumption that Clinton would win, which I think made it, that it made you think like, well, it's not a big deal because Clinton will just fill the seat, probably with somebody better. I don't know what it is. But I do think that making, Kavanaugh the symbol of, the new right-wing court, given his obvious partisanship and all of the problems with his personal character, could be very valuable. I hope we stop getting situations where, the court, completely guts the Voting Rights Act and it just doesn't seem to mobilize liberal voters at all. I think that's where it's valuable. You're not going to find anything that's going to get him removed from the court, but getting stuff that discredits him and further makes him the symbol of what the Supreme Court is, I think is valuable in itself.
Paul, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I guess I would just say that maybe this is a bit Pollyanna-ish, but I wouldn't rule out the possibility that something could come up that would actually make him make it impossible for him to stay there. I think that the baseball ticket story is so obviously false, and I can't see why that story exists if not to cover up something extremely unsavory. And if the Democrats take the House, they can subpoena, enough documents and people to get a long ways towards figuring out what that is. And it's, to me, it's conceivable that something could come up in this context that would actually be fatal, not perhaps in the sense of actually being convicted in a Senate trial, but in the sense of just making it politically untenable, perhaps. For him to stay, given that undoubtedly he has he has enemies on the right as well, and then the people whose ambitions were frustrated by him getting this seat, etc. So I don't think that's beyond the realm of possibility. But I agree with Scott that the more realistic goal is to keep delegitimizing and discrediting him. But I just want to mention one thing here, and I just want to, it's something that I've learned in the context of looking into various kinds of sordid goings on of one sort or another. When you find out that somebody is a liar, that it ought to completely discredit everything that they say about everything. I don't think that this can be emphasized enough in the case of somebody like Kavanaugh. Someone who lies like he did is probably lying about everything or everything that actually matters. And then you can go and look at his portfolio, as it were, and see it with completely different eyes. Let me just quickly reference here that, once I became convinced that Alice Goffman was making stuff up in her book, you read that book and you realize that a lot of it is made up, right? I mean, you might not be able to prove, you know, everything that's made up in it. But in other words, once you have no reason to even the credibility of a witness, then everything that they say is put into a completely different light. I think this guy is really dirty, and I think that that Democrats ought to keep digging into that, because the more of that dirt that comes to the surface, the better, no matter what the immediate consequences of that kind of digging may be.
Yeah, it's like Daniel Davies' classic Iraq War post about, you know, like all the things I learned at an expensive university, all the classic lines about how, but, you know, my favorite being that, you know, people talk a lot about the fallacy of the argument ad hominem, but there's no fancy Latin term for the fallacy of giving known liars the benefit of the doubt. It's a much bigger source of evil in the world. Once it's clear that the person speaking has no integrity, you can't take anything they say at face value. And I guess I would amend my previous comments to say I don't think there's any chance of Kavanaugh leaving the bench with a Democratic president and or Democratic Senate. There is the possibility that if something really bad comes, he may be forced to, quietly do an Abe Fortas. But the difference between that is that Fortas is willing to do that with Nixon in the White House. I can't imagine Kavanaugh giving, President Gillibrand a Supreme Court seat. But if something really bad were to emerge in 2019, assuming Republicans hold the Senate, it's not a strong possibility, but you never know. If it can be pointed out that, another person from Leonard Leo's list will get the job instead of Kavanaugh, it enhanced the credibility of the court without taking away its ideological balance. I would not rule that out 100%.
But let's use that to segue to I think the next, and there are two related questions here, but the first one is going to be, so let us say, and from our mouths to God's ears, that the Democrats have a majority in the Senate and they hold the presidency in 2020. What is the reaction then, right? I can see a number of options, right? I mean, one is just that Democratic justices act just as strategically as Republican justices do, and so RBG retires and so forth. But is there any chance for anything more than that, the sort of plans that people are floating around for packing the court or reducing the size of the court, or really any other sort of legislative efforts at changing how the court functions?
I think here it's really important to emphasize the potential value of what might be thought of as a kind of symbolic politics. I don't think there's any possibility of expanding the size of the Supreme Court in the immediate future, although that might change relatively rapidly given how radically events have moved. But what I do think is of great value and importance here would be for a Democratic Congress to just fire a few shots across the bow of the Supreme Court, basically, letting them know we are really serious about, our constitutional power to deal with a out of control or overreaching judiciary, given that almost all of your jurisdiction and the size of your institution is under our legislative control. So I think it's something that Democrats, and here I'm referencing what Scott was saying about the sort of failure of liberals to focus on the importance of these issues. I think it's imperative for Democrats and progressives to start to get really serious about fighting this battle with the same kind of ferocity and discipline that the right wing has fought. And that means – that doesn't necessarily mean managing to pass significant reformist legislation. I mean, it would be great if they could do that. But I still think it has great value to let the right wing in this country know that they just cannot you know, they just cannot continue down the path that they've been going without, you know, major consequences and major backlash. And, you know, I'm, of course, there will be a million, you know, hand-wringing editorials from, you know, Chris Klizza and David Brooks, et cetera, et cetera, about how terrible it is that the Democrats are politicizing the judiciary. But who cares? You know, I mean, we've got to put the, you know, we got to put some serious fear into these people. And I think that needs to be very high on the Democrats' priority list, assuming, you know, we can actually win some elections despite all the gerrymandering and vote suppression, et cetera.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's the idea that Democrats are going to, you know, take over in 2021 and immediately pass, you know, one of Jeffersonian, you know, attacks on the court. That's not going to happen. You know, there's not going to be majority support for that kind of behavior, barring something extraordinary, you know, happening in the interim. But, you know, the question is going to be, you know, is John Roberts going to make this, you know, a very conservative court, but one that allows Democrats to govern, or whether he's just going to just essentially make it impossible for a Democratic Congress to pass an agenda? And I think that his switch, you know, as Paul has put it, you know, the fact that Roberts wrote both the majority and dissenting opinions in Sebelius makes it clear that he changed his mind. You know, that he might, you know, understand that, you know, if the court, you know, narrows the, you know, Fourth Amendment, makes it harder to enforce the Voting Rights Act and so on, but, you know, allows the Democratic domestic agenda to pass, you know, the court is probably safe. And Roberts might understand that. But, you know, if, you know, some, you know, something that comes close to Medicare for All passes, and the court finds an excuse to strike it down, at that point, you're going to have serious, serious movement towards, manipulating the size of the court or jurisdiction stripping or whatever. At some point, it's not going to be, you know, as I said before, the failure of FDR's court packing plan was highly contingent. First of all, had the Senate majority leader not, you know, died, it could have happened. You know, it was essentially, you know, polling at close to 50-50. Democrats supported at 70-30. But obviously it failed in part because it was no longer necessary. But had the Supreme Court kept striking down New Deal legislation, something like that would have happened eventually. And it's the same thing here. You know, at some point, you know, no matter how much you value the nine-justice equilibrium, you know, if a you know, entrenched Supreme Court is just not going to let Democrats govern, you know, there's just no choice. And if that ends in judicial review being effectively eliminated, you know, that's going to be the cost that more and more people are going to pay. So I think that will really depend. But there's another variable here, too, which is what if Republicans control the Senate and, God forbid, Breyer or Ginsburg doesn't make it? At that point, it's beyond Roberts' control. You know, and who's the median vote of the court in that case? Like, Thomas? it's frightening. So that's another thing, too, is that we may be in a situation where, you know, there's, you know, six or seven orthodox Republicans, and at that point, really, all bets are off. But, you know, essentially, it's just a question of when the constitutional crisis is happening and not if.
Right. So let me actually jump a little bit more on that. So, you know, obviously the Republicans in the Senate simply refused to hear Merrick Garland, right? And we also have probably a pretty good notion, or at least what people have been floating, is that were, for example, the Democrats to take the Senate, seems unlikely, but it's possible this time around, that and there were there another justice to open up, that Trump simply wouldn't appoint anyone. Are we in a situation right now where it's, you know, basically impossible for a president to appoint a Supreme Court justice with an opposition-controlled Senate? I mean, do you need the control of both the Senate and the presidency to increase the number of people on the court at this point?
I would say, I would put it this way. I am 100% sure that a Republican Senate will never confirm a Supreme Court nominee of a Democratic president. I think that's pretty clear.
What's the last Democratic nominee who was confirmed by a Republican Senate?
Do you know this? It was Rufus Peckham, a Cleveland nominee who, of course, wrote Walker versus New York. So that's not. So I would say that is that doesn't really count. In other words, so but basically, it doesn't happen. You know, even in a less partisan time, it didn't happen. So now, and that's partly an artifact of you know, the Democratic coalition controlling the Senate for so much of the 20th century. But still, yeah, so that you literally have to go back to the author of Walker versus New York to find a Democratic nominee who is acceptable to the Republican Senate. So yeah, that's not happening. But I would say that, you know, probably a Democratic Senate would not confirm, you know, like I think it's 90% that if Democrats took over, they would not approve, especially replacement for Ginsburg and Breyer. I find it hard to believe that maybe even higher than 90%, even, you know, a 51, you know, seat majority. Because, you know, even Manchin this time, he did held his firm, you know, in the sense that he made it clear that he would not be the deciding vote for Kavanaugh, which, in my opinion, is about all you can expect, although a lot of people disagree. But, you know, I can't imagine that. I could say that, you know, a very slim Democratic majority in some circumstances might approve a Republican judge, but I think we're getting pretty close to that. And certainly, I think we'll never see an opposition Senate confirm a pivotal Supreme Court nomination again. That, you know, maybe you could get somebody confirmed that wouldn't shift the balance of the court. But certainly, anything that could affect the media of the court, I think it would be almost impossible. Even, you know, with the, in a Republican president, Democratic Senate situation, you know, I just don't. It's very hard to see any even red state Democrat voting to allow Ginsburg or Breyer to be replaced with a Republican. So I think more or less that's true. That you know, essentially you'll only be able to get a Supreme Court nominee confirmed with a unified government.
We do seem to have lost Paul, at least temporarily. My last question is this. There has been some criticism of the Democrats basically on two avenues. One, I think you've referred to as the Democrats' inability to turn 49 into 51. So we can speak briefly to that, perhaps. But there have also been some people who have argued that, you know, the Democrats effectively, Harry Reid effectively opened the door to no judicial filibusters, right? And so, you know, were it not for decisions made during his majority, that the Democrats simply would have been able to filibuster not only Kavanaugh but also Neil Gorsuch. You know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so this is all insane. So the easiest one to dismiss, which, you know, I wrote about earlier, you know, a couple times, is, you know, basically people who spent 2016, you know, arguing that, you know, Clinton and Trump are the same, you know whether or not they ultimately, you know, said that you should vote for, you know, that obviously the Supreme Court is far from the only way in which they'd be massively different, but it's one of the most obvious and hardest to change. So there's obviously a felt necessity when Trump, you know, gets the Supreme Court appointments to say that there's some way in which the Democrats could have stopped them, you know, and that's often, you know, that's the sort of, you know, like the Glenn Greenwald position, right? That actually more right-wing presidents get more left-wing results because, you know, right-wing presidents generate opposition. And, you know, as we all know, an Uncle Sam on stilts at a demonstration can pretty much stop the United States government from doing anything. You know, and I'm not sure if these people were alive during the Iraq War or what, but anyway. So that's obviously, so there's this idea that, you know, asking exactly the right questions at Kavanaugh's hearing or whatever, you know, it's sort of, or my favorite, you know, pointing out that Kavanaugh was part of the Bush administration and did things supported by the Bush administration would somehow stop a Republican Senate from voting for him is just sort of fantasy land. But yeah, so that's really the easy one. The other question is, you know, the somewhat more serious one, because you seem to even see this advanced by a couple of Democratic senators, is the idea that it was a mistake to allow, you know, that it was sort of a fatal mistake to allow to have ended the filibuster for judicial nominations, because, you know, without that, you know, McConnell wouldn't have been able to get Gorsuch and Kavanaugh confirmed. And again, that's just absolutely nutty. First of all, there's a huge cost being paid for that. You know, the Republicans were blockading the D.C. Circuit, so Trump would have immediately been able to create a majority on the nation's second court. So that's a huge cost. And obviously the idea that McConnell would just, you know, keep, you know, one or two Supreme Court seats open for 2 years is just absolutely just insanely wrong. You know, so basically the only way that the filibuster could have been preserved is if Democrats just voted for Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. And I think if you look at the impetus for confirming Kavanaugh, the filibuster wouldn't have mattered. That would have, you know, allowing the Democrats to filibuster Kavanaugh would have been seen as a loss, which they weren't taking, you know. It really makes no sense. And it's disturbing the extent to which Democrats, you know, even having seen McConnell throw out the blue slip norm after Democrats tried to uphold it, the fact that, so many Democrats still don't seem to fully understand where the Republicans are coming from on this is frankly a little disturbing. To be clear, Reid absolutely did the right thing. And the filibuster for federal judicial appointments was going either way. That the only way it could have been saved is if what happened during the Bush administration with Democrats saving it by basically agreeing not to use it, which obviously doesn't make any sense. Elections have consequences, and when Republicans control the White House and the Senate, they're going to confirm a ton of judges, and liberals just have to be willing to do likewise.
All right. Well, Scott, do you have anything else to add? We know now that his computer ran out of battery. So let this be a lesson, everyone. Charge your batteries.
That's a sign that with that we should probably wrap up.
yeah, exactly. So nothing else you want to add?
No, that's good.
All right. So, gentlemen, thank you very much. And the listeners who've gotten this far, thank you very much as well. And please continue to read LGM and listen to our podcast.
Yeah. Thanks for listening and reading.